From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Playwright and actor Wallace Shawn and theater director Andre Gregory turned their conversations into art in their film My Dinner with Andre. On today's Fresh Air, we bring them together for more conversation about theater and the meaning of life. They're both in the new film Vanya on 42nd Street. John Dominic Crossan is a former priest. He gave up the calling to study the Bible in a historical context. We'll talk with him about his biography of Jesus and how his historical research affects his faith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The rains may be over for now, but water continues to rise in southeast Texas. Rescue crews have continued evacuating residents. Lisa Garvin of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
National Guard troops continue to arrive in southeast Texas, where they have their work cut out for them. Using helicopters and amphibious vehicles, troopers will rescue those residents in Conroe and Liberty who are still threatened by rising water. Military police have also been deployed in the hardest hit areas to deal with looters. State Emergency Management Coordinator Tom Milwe says what assistance can be rendered at this point is already underway, but damage assessments will have to wait until the waters recede. So far, 10,000 people have been chased from their homes, but officials fear that that will increase as the San Jacinto River continues to rise to record levels. The Houston area is also braced for downstream flooding. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Garvin in Houston.
An Israeli official says PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has offered to help find those behind today's bombing aboard a Tel Aviv bus. The Muslim radical group Hamas has claimed responsibility. Israeli officials have threatened to retaliate. Arafat says continuing talks on peace and Palestinian self-rule is the only way to respond. He says the bombers are trying to disrupt the process. Israeli authorities say they believe a suicide bomber carrying 22 to 44 pounds of explosives is responsible for the blast that killed 22 people. One witness says she remembers seeing a man sitting in the fifth row holding a large bag. In Washington, President Clinton is calling the attack an outrage against the conscience of the world. Egypt, Syria, and six Gulf states have urged Iraq to recognize Kuwait fully and without conditions. The call was made at a meeting of foreign ministers in Cairo. Alfred Hermida reports.
The meeting in Cairo was called by Egypt to discuss the crisis provoked by Iraqi troop movements towards the Kuwaiti border. The Egyptians, together with the Syrians, were disappointed that Kuwait and its Gulf neighbors turned to the United States for military help rather than to its Arab partners. At the Cairo meeting, the foreign ministers put their differences behind them to present a united front. They denounced the Iraqi troop movement, saying they threatened not only Kuwait, but the whole region. The ministers called on Iraq to comply with United Nations resolutions and to abandon its claim to Kuwait by recognizing its sovereignty and borders. For National Public Radio, this is Alfred Hamida in Cairo.
The Commerce Department says the trade deficit got nearly 13% smaller in August, despite a big increase in imports, because of more exports of U.S. goods, including airplanes and computer chips. The rise in imports was fueled mainly by Japanese cars. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 19 points in heavy trading of 309 million shares. This is NPR. The judge in the O.J. Simpson trial has asked three broadcasters not to air interviews they've done with Faye Resnick, the co-author of a book about Simpson's murdered ex-wife. Resnick, who was a friend of Nicole Simpson, says in the book that O.J. Simpson stalked his ex-wife and threatened to kill her. Interviewer Maury Povich is one of those the judge has asked not to broadcast an interview with Resnick because it might influence potential jurors. Povich says the show will air as scheduled. The judge also has asked CNN and CBS to delay showing the interviews. They have not responded yet. Northern Illinois police officials believe they have recovered most of a huge cache of stolen explosives. About 900 pounds of dynamite were taken from a Rockford, Illinois quarry. Sue Stevens of member station WNIJ reports.
Police have cordoned off a field in southeast Rockford where three girls discovered the stolen dynamite Tuesday afternoon. Bomb squad technicians are in the process of removing the explosives. Police do not have any solid leads in the case. Someone apparently bulldozed the doors to a shed at the quarry, then stole a truck loaded with the commercial-grade dynamite. The theft of this amount of explosives is rare anywhere in the country, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Investigators are also looking into the possibility of a connection between this incident and a truck bomb that critically injured the alleged leader of a local biker gang last week. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Stevens in DeKalb.
German prosecutors have closed the case in the death of Austrian skier Ulrike Meyer, who died of injuries suffered in a fall during a World Cup downhill race last winter. Authorities have been looking for indications of negligence by the organizers of the race, but they said today the organizers took sufficient safety measures. They say when Meyer fell, she hit the back of her neck on a mound of snow, not on a timing post, as television pictures seem to indicate. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Vanya on 42nd Street, reunites actor and playwright Wally Shawn with actor and theater director Andre Gregory. They played themselves in the 1981 film My Dinner with Andre. Pauline Kael described My Dinner with Andre as a mad tea party about the meaning of life. The movie is a dinner conversation between the two men. Andre tells Wally why he dropped out of the theater to go on a spiritual quest that led him across the desert and through the forest. Wally is captivated but baffled by this exotic search, explaining he takes comfort in the smaller pleasures of life, like staying home with a cup of coffee. Andre has since returned to the theater. One of his more absorbing projects was directing a production of Chekhov's play Uncle Vanya, starring Wally Shawn as Vanya. Their production was recently filmed by Louis Malle, who also directed My Dinner with Andre. The new movie, Vanya on 42nd Street, opened today in New York. The film gave us the perfect opportunity to bring together Wally Shawn and Andre Gregory and to let me get in on the act. Vanya is about people who are disappointed in life and for the most part don't accept any responsibility for the emptiness of their own lives. And I'm wondering if you both often ask yourselves if you're happy, and if you have any sense of what being sufficiently happy is. You know how sometimes you ask yourself, am I happy? Well, am I happy enough? Should I be more happy? Are other people happier than I am? Do you ask yourselves these questions a lot?
Well, I'll answer it, but then you have to. To speak of the play first, I'm trying to play Vanya as someone who does not accept his own misery, and even his bitterness is a form of struggle against it. And yes, I myself have. I figure that I've been given every privilege that a person could possibly have been given, and I've had all the luck that a person could possibly have. So if I'm not enjoying it, it's absolutely pitiful. I mean, there was a time when I felt that I really didn't deserve to be happy, so why should I be? And now I'm more in a mood of thinking that if I'm not happy, who possibly could be? So it's bad luck to say it, maybe, but I got sick of being miserable and very bored with that, and now I feel I somehow accept the idea of enjoying myself more than I did.
Andre, what about you?
Well, I think Wally just said a very important word, which is the word I accept for me, because, you know, we talk a lot about being happy or sad, when in fact, I think in any given day, if we really paid attention to what was going on in ourselves, we would find that we were exquisitely happy, despairing, insane, from moment to moment, that this changes. But there are these lines in Vanya when in the last act Vanya's saying, what am I going to do with my life? Give me some pain, you know, some painkillers. How am I going to get through the next 13 years? And the doctor says, oh, shut up. He says, this that you're living is your life. And, you know, I remember some years back my wife was quite ill and somebody said to me, this must be incredibly hard for you. And it was incredibly hard, but at the same time, you know, I said to them that when I was in college, my first year, I did nothing but play poker all the time. And when you play poker, anybody can win with four queens or a full house. The art of living is really playing with a bad hand if you're not living in a ghetto.
Well, Andre, when you talk about accepting what you've been given, there was a time when you had left the theater, you dropped out of the theater and you went on this like spiritual search, going to India and the Sahara, looking for some spiritual meaning in life. Would you do something like that at this point in your life, or is all of that behind you?
No, it's not behind me, because I think I'm still some kind of a seeker. But I've come around to the Wally character's point of view in my dinner with Andre, that you don't have to go to the Himalayas or the top of a mountain to do it. Gee, I don't know if you remember those lines.
This is the cigar store part where Wally's
right.
arguing you could find all of the world, all of reality, yes. just in the neighborhood cigar store.
Absolutely.
You don't have to climb to the top of Mount Everest find what life means.
I think you can do it within yourself, that the journey can be an inner journey. Yes?
I was going to say, Wally, what about you? Do you still uphold your part of the argument about the cigar store?
Well, not really, because the guy who made the cigars or who was growing the tobacco is probably... you can't learn about that guy from being in the cigar store. So I sort of now feel that there are certain facts about the world and how the world works that you need to travel and study about to learn about. I mean, the way the world works as a political entity is not necessarily visible just from your own neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. I have a theater question for both of you. Doing a play like Chekhov's Uncle Vanya, but doing it in an updated form, I think of you both as being pretty experimental and adventurous in your approaches to theater. And I'm curious about what interests you in taking something that's, you know, a classic from another century and bringing it into the present, as opposed to something that's just really from the present, something that's more experimental or avant-garde?
Well, certainly there's a technical challenge to say lines that were written, say, 85 years ago or whatever, and say them so that it really is something that you are saying today.
Mm-hmm. Could you not do it straight? I mean, you're working with the David Mamet adaptation, which is pretty contemporary sounding. If you were to take an older translation and to do it as a classic without any updating, Wally, do you think you could act in something like that? Do you have the sensibility for that type of classic theater?
Well, you know, Mamet's translation I think if you were to read it...
Is it really pretty close?
Yeah.
You would not... it's not brought up to date. It's just put into English that is not slangy or contemporary. It's just put into, you know, modern English in a way that is very speakable. Mm-hmm. I mean, most translations are bad because they contain words or phrases that may literally convey what was in the original, but which no human being would ever actually say to another human being. It is practically impossible for a contemporary actor to make it totally believable to say, But my dear Mrs. Elvsted, don't you see, my dear? We don't behave in such a way. Am I right, eh? This is the type of translation language that it's not good writing. It's not good English, really. Mm-hmm. It's not idiomatic. It's not the way anybody talks. So you can never say that line with total conviction.
Andre, what about your interest in taking classic theater, even though you're a kind of experimentalist by sensibility?
Well, now that I'm old, I've become a classicist. Well, you see, I don't think of Vanya as in any way old or a classic. You know, there were a lot of playwrights and writers who came to see us when we were doing it for small groups, you know, like John Guare, Michael Weller, people like that, who were staggered by how modern this play is.
I think that the idea of, first of all, the idea of a classic play in a way is a contradiction in terms. The play is supposed to mean something today. That's what theater is really about. But people lay on top of Chekhov a fake layer of so-called classicism where people are, let's say, indulging themselves in drifting into a dream of some idealized world of the past. I don't want to insult. It's very hard to be blunt without insulting people. So let's just say that we've all enjoyed masterpiece theater work, I'm sure. I certainly have. But that wasn't what Chekhov was imagining that he was a masterpiece or a kind of marvelous world of the past where people would wear wonderful costumes and people would look at it and say, oh, isn't it wonderful they didn't have sex back then. It's not really about that. I mean, Chekhov was, you know, crawling through the mud, writing the truth about the world as he was able to, and it really has nothing to do with drifting into a beautiful fantasy about the past. So that classical thing is laid on top of it, and so we're just not laying it on top of it.
That's why it's Vanya on 42nd Street.
Right. It strikes me that you've both been in some movies or even TV shows or plays that were so unlike what your own body of work is about. Well, Andre, for you, I'm thinking of like Neil Simon's Broadway comedy Rumours.
How about Demolition Man?
Good example.
Let's trace the similarities.
And I mean, Wally, you've been on TV shows like Murphy Brown, Deep Space Nine. Well, Murphy Brown, God, I mean, that's Louis Malle's wife who stars in that, so I could see the connection. Deep Space Nine, Heaven Help Us. I'm just picking out things that seem really out of character to you. So I'm wondering, when you're in like a TV show or a Broadway comedy or a mainstream movie that's really like outside of your sensibility, do you try to like fit in and have fun with it, or do you feel like an alien during it?
I love it. You know, being on a movie set with a trailer and all these interesting people to meet and all of that food and a completely different way of life, I mean, that's more exciting for me than going to Provence for a holiday. It's partly a holiday. I love it. It's very different. Also, it's the only way, it seems, I can make money. In these last few years, I've had to, you know, find a way to keep Vanya going. I love being in a place that I'm really uncomfortable, you know.
No, why would you love that?
I don't know. I shouldn't say I love it. it scares the hell out of me. It does scare the hell out of me. But for some reason, I have to keep being in the unknown. I don't like it. And for me to be in a Neil Simon comedy on Broadway is stranger for me than wandering around the desert with a Japanese monk on a camel. That's stranger. And on some level, I'm a learner. I love to learn. And you do learn generally, mostly, when you're in an uncomfortable situation. So I've liked it.
Well, is it uncomfortable for you when you're in something that's very mainstream and outside your sensibility?
Well, during the time that I'm doing the thing, it is often a wonderful relief for me, because I don't always enjoy carrying my own sensibility around with me all the time. Sometimes it's not that much fun. And it's a wonderful thing for me to be able to drop it. And it is disturbing, because there is this idea that you should be one person. And obviously, if, for instance, if others know you in a way that is wildly different from the way that you think that you know yourself, it does present a problem in regard to your identity. I mean, people come up to me on the street and tell me who I am, and I'm learning something from that. They literally say, "You're the guy from The Princess Bride. You're the guy who says inconceivable in The Princess Bride." And that's information. I'm asking the question, who am I? And someone comes up to me on the street and tells me who I am, but the information is not anything that I would have guessed myself when I was asking who am I to myself. So that can become very complicated.
You can see Wally Shawn and Andre Gregory in the new movie Vanya on 42nd Street, an adaptation of Uncle Vanya. This is Fresh Air. If I could create a perfect radio world, every interview would be as interesting as listening to Wally Shawn and Andre Gregory talk about theater and life. And in that perfect world, public radio would have all the money it needed. But the world is imperfect. So this week, public radio hosts all around America are butting into their programs to remind you that we can't go on without your support. But you know, this fundraising business isn't such a bad deal. We're asking for pennies a day to bring you conversations with wonderful people who make you think and make you laugh and sometimes even make you see your life in a slightly different way. Thanks to all the listeners who've called so far. Here's how to call with a pledge. Rock historian Ed Ward is going to tell us about an unparalleled recording session, the Elvis Presley Million Dollar Quartet. It features Presley, along with his friends Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, relaxing and playing in the Sun Record Studios in Memphis in 1956.
There's no place like home. Well, now I say home.
It was December 4th, 1956, and the Sun Studios were abuzz with activity. Singer and guitarist Carl Perkins was finally out of the hospital after the auto accident that had taken the momentum from the success of his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. And earlier in the day, he'd come to Sun to cut another record, Matchbox, that he hoped would get him back on track. Sam Phillips, who owned the place, thought Carl's arrangement needed some beef and called in a young piano player, Jerry Lee Lewis, who'd just started recording for Sun. Jerry Lee needed the work. He was sleeping on his uncle's couch, and his first record had only come out 2 days before, so he was dead broke. By 4 o'clock, Perkins was sung out, so they ended the session. They were confident that Matchbox was going to be a big hit, because in the middle of the playbacks, Elvis had walked in with a girlfriend and had heard the track and pronounced it great. Elvis was a huge star by now, but he couldn't help dropping by Sun to see his old friends. So when the official recording was over, he walked into the studio room and sat down with Carl and Jerry Lee.
You belong to my heart. Remember that? Now and forever. Yeah. We were there beneath the stars while a million guitars played our love song. When they said I love you, every beat of my heart said it too. Solemn table of it.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Almost immediately, somebody turned on the tape recorder, and with some gaps where tape reels were changed, nearly everything that happened in the studio for the next 90 minutes was documented. They started off with gospel music, a common ground the three men shared.
Will this Rover Boys trio sing Farther Along? Will this Rover Boys
trio? Give us a D chord.
Have a little chord here.
Ten.
Yeah.
That's it.
Tempted and tried, we're all made to wonder why it should be thus, but in all.
By now, there were more people in the studio, and nobody's quite sure who was doing what. But Elvis's voice is distinctive enough that it stood out. Everybody wanted to have Elvis record their songs. Even Sam Phillips pitched a song to him. And Elvis, sounding a little uncomfortable, agreed to listen to it. Nowhere is Elvis's newfound relationship to his fame more evident than in this portrait of Jackie Wilson, though.
Billy Ward and his dominoes. There's a guy out there who's done a takeoff on me. Don't be cruel. He tried so hard until he got much better, boy. Much better than that record of mine. Oh, no, wait now. I mean, it's this way. He was real slender. He was a colored guy. He got up there and he said, he had a little slower than me. Started off. He said, what kind of key did I do it in? What key did I do? Don't be cruel, man. He said, hey, you know I can't be found.
Wait, son.
Sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least there's a telephone.
And he had his feet turned in like this, and all the time was singing, and feet was going in and out, both ways, sliding like this.
He says, hey, you know I can't be found.
Oh,
he says, at least, please. A
telephone?
Don't be...
It's evident that Elvis was in awe of the skinny young singer who was still with Billy Ward's Dominoes, still a couple of years from the records that would make him famous. Elvis's being in the studio was news, and while the tapes rolled, Sam Phillips did a very smart thing. He called the local newspaper, and then he called Johnny Cash, another young singer who, like Jerry Lee Lewis, was just getting his career going at Sun. A carefully posed photograph, taken when they arrived, shows Elvis seated at the piano with Jerry Lee, Carl, and Johnny with their mouths open, supposedly singing. This photo later gave rise to the name for this tape jam session, the Million Dollar Quartet, although Cash is heard nowhere on the tape and left right after his photo was taken. The Carl Perkins Band had a show that night, and they left, too.
That's why I hate to start in this jam session. I'm always the last one to leave. Always.
Pretty soon, Elvis left for the control room to talk with Sam Phillips and some fans. And Jerry Lee, whose ego can be heard trying to burst the bounds of politeness, did a one-man show for the microphone. It was, we hear somebody note, 5:30. It was supper time. Time to be with the family, tell them about the amazing fun you'd had this afternoon. Fun that, through some miracle, was preserved on a bunch of reels of tape.
Rock historian Ed Ward, this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the historical Jesus. We talk with biblical scholar and former priest John Dominic Crossan. He's written a biography of Christ as a Jewish Mediterranean peasant who preached egalitarianism. Crossan will tell us how he interprets the events of Jesus' life and how his historical research has affected his faith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton has condemned the bombing of a bus in Israel as an outrage against the conscience of the world. Mr. Clinton also says the bombing was committed by enemies of peace. Israeli officials are speculating that a suicide attack blew apart the crowded Tel Aviv bus, leaving 22 people dead and dozens injured. The BBC's Jackie Rowland reports on the aftermath of the bombing.
Anonymous callers to Israeli and Palestinian radio stations said the Islamic group Hamas was behind the attack. The group carried out a similar suicide bombing earlier this year. Hamas is committed to wrecking the peace deal signed between the PLO and Israel a year ago. The Israeli army has sealed off the West Bank and Gaza Strip until further notice. Such closures cause extreme hardship for Palestinians in the occupied territories who are prevented from going to work in Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has cut short a visit to London, where he was discussing the Middle East peace process with British leaders. Israeli government officials say this latest act of violence should not be allowed to derail the peace talks. The PLO leader Yasser Arafat echoed this. Condemning the bombing, he said the best response was to push ahead with the peace process.
Jackie Rowland in Jerusalem. The Iraqi government says one of its facilities has been bombed. Baghdad says a bomb went off at the Ministry of Religious Affairs, causing several injuries and damage to an office. News photographers who went to the scene say no damage is visible from outside and they were not allowed inside. The federal government has issued new guidelines aimed at reducing the number of breast cancer deaths in the U.S. NPR's Joe Palca has this report.
The National Cancer Institute estimates there will be some 180,000 new cases of breast cancer this year, and 46,000 women will die from the disease. The odds of preventing death from breast cancer get better if you catch the disease at its earliest stage, and to do that, the federal government has long recommended that women regularly examine their breasts for lumps, and in some cases seek annual breast x-rays called mammograms. The new guidelines say women who do get mammograms should make sure they're getting high-quality mammograms done with modern x-ray equipment by specially trained technicians. They also say that women should demand the results of their mammograms in writing and make sure they know who to call if they don't receive a written report. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The consumer group that has warned about high fat levels in Chinese, Italian, and Mexican food and movie theater popcorn has found a type of repast it can recommend, generally speaking. The Center for Science in the Public Interest says seafood is usually safe to order. Just stay away from the fried dishes. The center recommends seafood that is baked, broiled, blackened, or grilled. The report says seafood restaurants offer more healthy, low-fat choices than others. On Wall Street, the Dow closed 19 points higher today. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. This is NPR. New Jersey has become one of the first states in the country to require contractors to call a utility hotline before they dig. The law is designed to prevent pipeline explosions. Gene Dillard reports from Trenton.
It was the gas explosion which rocked the town of Edison, New Jersey last March and destroyed seven apartment buildings, which prompted legislation just signed by Governor Christy Whitman. The bill requires contractors to call a special hotline number before they dig, so underground lines can be marked prior to excavation. Violators could face fines of up to $500,000. The governor's chief legal counsel, Peter Verniero, says this new law could save lives.
The significance is this will put in place a system to provide safeguards against accidental damage to underground lines, which could result in serious consequences to the citizens of the state.
New Jersey's new law is being used as a model for legislation in other states and for a federal bill now pending in Congress. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
UN peacekeepers in Bosnia say they're running low on fuel because of the Bosnian Serb blockade that's also keeping civilian aid from getting through. The peacekeepers are warning they'll take what they call extremely strong action against the Serbs. A spokesman for the peacekeepers says the fuel shortage is reaching the point where UN forces won't be able to operate. The UN troops are also facing defiance from the Bosnian army. The UN says it has not been able to persuade government troops to leave a demilitarized zone outside Sarajevo. The Serbs have threatened to try to move the government soldiers themselves. The U.S. is trying to get support from its allies to lift the Bosnian arms embargo 6 months from now. Britain, France, and Russia are against removing the embargo. Russia is a traditional ally of the Serbs, and France and Britain are worried that their peacekeeping troops will be attacked by the Bosnian Serbs in retaliation if the West starts flooding weapons into the government's arsenals. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Dominic Crossan is an expert on the historical Jesus. His latest book is called Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. He writes about Jesus as a man, a Mediterranean Jewish peasant who preached equality. Crossan uses the tools of anthropology, history, and literary criticism to reconstruct the life of Jesus. As you can guess, Crossan's work is controversial. He's a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University in Chicago and a former priest. He co-founded the Jesus Seminar, a group of scholars who debate what Jesus really said and did. I spoke with Crossan last spring, just before Easter. I asked him if there are events that history can't explain, only faith can. Like the virgin birth.
Let me take that as a very, very good example. As a historian, I'm looking at two texts now. There is a story in Suetonius, the pagan Roman historian, who tells us that the night that Augustus, the emperor at the time that Jesus was born, the night he was conceived, his mother Atzia went to the temple of Apollo, fell asleep during the service and stayed there overnight, and Apollo, the god Apollo, impregnated her, and the child conceived, of course, was Augustus, or later to be Augustus. And that same night, her husband, Octavius, dreamt that he saw the sun rising from his wife's womb. Now, that is a story. I then look over at the story in Luke, and I find Mary is overshadowed by the Holy Spirit, and in Matthew that the husband, Joseph, has a dream about the child to be born being the Savior. I have two stories. As a historian, I do not accept either of those as factual, actual, biological stories. I don't think either of them happened, if you could have been there, as it were, to have observed. But as a Christian, I am challenged to ask, in which of those stories do I find a dramatic visualization of God? Do I find God over on the Palatine Palace with power, with domination from the top down with the Emperor Augustus? Or do I find God in a peasant child born in a peasant stable, empowerment from the bottom upwards? And I have not the slightest hesitation in answering where I find God. I find God in Jesus, not Augustus. But that is an act of faith, not a statement of fact. If I was a Roman aristocrat, of course, I would be happy to find God glowing on Augustus. That's the difference between history and faith.
So,
and between story and history, too.
So in your faith, what do you make of the virgin birth? Do you see it as just a metaphor, or do you think that there was a miracle that happened?
The only word I would be nervous about is just a metaphor, because for me, metaphors are the...
Right.
I'm not picking on your words. Metaphors for me are what we live and die for. Metaphors are the ultimate meaning of life. They are our most profound interpretation. So yes, I do consider it a metaphor. No, I do not consider the biological statement about either Atzia or Mary. They are creedal statements, statements of faith about where you find God.
You know, a lot of people are afraid that if the historical authenticity of the Bible is questioned, if people ask, did it really happen? And if the answer is, well, no, it might not have, then people will have no faith, that Christianity will cease to mean anything as a religion. Do you worry about that, or do you think it's possible to have faith even if the faith isn't something literal?
I think it's going to be necessary, because we are living increasingly in a multicultural world, and I don't say that just to be politically correct. I stand in front of an
of the undergraduate class every September, and I can tell by the faces it's getting more and more multicultural. Underneath the multicultural layer is multicreedal layers. We are going to have to learn to live with other religions, and we cannot get away with claiming that our religion, let us say Christianity, has certain facts which never happened to any other religion. They have just myths or stories, but we have facts. That's not going to work anymore. We all base our lives on myth, Christians just as much as everyone else.
Let's talk a little bit about crucifixion. This was a pretty common punishment in the time of Jesus. What was it punishment for? What kinds of people were crucified?
If you knew that Jesus had been crucified and knew nothing else about him, you'd know two things immediately. First of all, that he was lower class. And secondly, that this was some form of what was seen as subversion against the Roman order. It was not done to the upper classes, and it was not done probably just for a petty criminal or a petty robber. It was really state terrorism. It was intended to terrorize people so they would not do the same thing. So you were, in a way, hung out for everyone to see. And part of the terror of crucifixion, and part of what made it one of the three Roman supreme penalties, like being tossed to the beast, being burned alive, or being crucified, was that very often there was nothing left to bury. That's what made it a supreme penalty. It wasn't calculated simply as being more painful, because the Romans never bothered about such things. It was that it was public, it was humiliating, and above all, you would be left on the cross for the crows and the dogs and the wild animals. There might be nothing left to bury. And that was what was terrible about it.
What do you make of the resurrection?
The resurrection means for me that the power of God, which was present in Jesus, but confined, say, to Lower Galilee or Judea and to those people who could come in immediate contact with him, is now available to anyone anywhere in the world who wishes to find God in Jesus, who believes that God is available in Jesus. It has nothing to do, as far as I am concerned, literally, with a body coming out of the tomb or a tomb being found empty or visions or anything else. All of those are dramatic ways of expressing it. What is the heart of resurrection for me is the experience that the power of God is now available through Jesus, untrammeled, unconfined by time or space. That is, for me, the essence of resurrection.
But what would explain the disappearance of the body?
I don't know if we have to explain the disappearance of the body, because that presumes that we are taking the stories that we have there literally.
Mm-hmm.
What I understood happened, this is my historical reconstruction, the disciples fled, and they said they fled. I do not think they knew anything beyond the bare facts that Jesus was taken, Jesus was crucified. And their most terrible thought, their most awful thought, was that maybe nobody had buried him. And it's hard for us to realize how terrible that was in the ancient world. It's much more terrible even than it would be for us, to be left unburied, unmourned, sort of annihilated your identity as a human being. Now, the only hope would be maybe some pious Jewish person might have buried Jesus. But then by the time you get to John's account, you have a full, beautiful, magnificent, royal anointing, pounds of precious ointment, a garden tomb, than which you could not imagine a more perfect burial. I cannot take those as factual accounts because of their differences and because of their inherent apologetic threatened to get Jesus properly buried. I don't think the first Christians knew what happened to the body of Jesus.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, author of Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. I'm sure you have great admiration for Gandhi and for Martin Luther King. These are figures who we revere for the work that they did. But it's different than the relationship a Christian has with Jesus. Jesus is a figure of worship, not just a historical figure that you respect enormously for the sacrifices that he made. Where does it come in for you that Jesus is worthy of religious reverence and not just, you know, the kind of historical respect we pay to our greatest and most enlightened leaders?
I am not at all certain, Terry, that if a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King had not been in the right place at the right time, which simply wasn't where they were, that they might not be so revered as such figures. Because to say that somebody is divine means that I, as a believer, whoever this believer is, find God in this person. It's an act of faith. If enough Christians had not found God in Jesus, then Jesus would not be divine for me. It's an interactive relationship between God, this person, and a believer. So if, for example, millions of Hindus had begun to find, say, Gandhi as an incarnation of Krishna, then he would have been an incarnation of Krishna, and he could have become the incarnation of Krishna. There is no way that you and I could say that could not have happened. And had it happened, it would have been true.
So your historical research has not shaken your faith?
No. What it has helped me is to distinguish between an act of faith and a statement of fact.
And
that is very important to know the difference.
Tell us what the difference is to you and how that affects how you live your life.
Well, for example, if I were to take, we talked about the virgin birth a couple of times, supposing I were to say, no, that is a fact. It's a biological fact. It would be ascertainable if, for example, we had medical examinations possible at the time. Then you're saying that faith is in facts, and I do not believe faith is ever in a fact. If I said to you, I don't believe in America, you would know immediately. I'm not saying I don't believe there's landmass between Canada and Mexico. You'd know I must be saying I don't believe in America as the land of opportunity, the land of the free and the home of the brave, as the place of the future, whatever. Somehow it would be a way of seeing America. It would not be the fact of America. It would be the interpretation of America. So an act of faith, for me, is always an interpretation. It is really a fundamental interpretation. And it's necessary to know the difference between a fact, which should be available to anyone who has the available methods of checking it, and an interpretation, which may not be able to be proved or disproved, especially if it's an act of faith, which is fundamental interpretation.
You write that to remove that which is radically subversive, socially revolutionary, and politically dangerous from Jesus' actions is to leave his life meaningless and his death inexplicable.
Well, thank you. That was a nice sentence. I've forgotten that one. Yes, I mean, Jesus was put to death by the authorities, and the Romans may have abused power, but they didn't waste it. So he did something that really bothered them. And to make it sound like he was a nice little kid going around, sorry, a nice person going around and patting little babies on the head and telling sweet little stories, and some inexplicable way they managed to kill him, it makes no sense of anything. What he was doing was socially subversive in the first century, and probably in the 20th century. I don't know how we'd get him today, but we'd get him somehow. We'd either trivialize him or we would destroy him.
So with Easter coming up, tell me what Easter means to you.
I cannot separate the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. I wouldn't just put all the emphasis on the death as if the life was not important. The death is, first of all, connected to the life. The life that Jesus was living as a social revolutionary, the only question in your mind was, when will they get him and where? Will it be Antipas in Galilee, or will it be Pilate down in Judea? So you're waiting, in a way, for something to happen. The death makes sense against that background. It is not that Jesus goes out looking to get himself killed, but if anyone does what Jesus does, they have to be ready to die. So I put the death along with the life. Then what is extraordinary is that instead of ending it there, which is what they hoped to do, it continued. If no Christian had ever written anything for the first 100 years after Jesus' death, we would have Josephus, the Jewish historian, and Tacitus, the pagan Roman historian, telling us three things. There was a movement over there in Judea. We officially executed its founder, but it continued. Josephus says those who loved him before continued to love him afterwards. Tacitus says, with a marvelous sneer on his face, the disease broke out again and spread all the way to Rome, where everything rotten comes eventually. Now, those three things, movement, execution, continuation, those are the raw data of history that can be seen from an outsider. That really is, from an outsider, what Easter is about. From the insider, then, it's up to them to explain in their own language How come they still believe in Jesus, even though he was put to death, even though he was executed? And that belief is the resurrection.
In other words, that belief is what keeps Jesus alive.
That's what keeps Jesus alive. Put in the simplest language, nobody believes Jesus is dead and gone forever. And that could have happened in the first century. That is why I have tremendous, tremendous awe for the faith of the first Christians, and I don't like to see it trivialized as if they had a terrible day on Friday and then it was all solved by Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoon, Easter Sunday, is the condensation, as it were, of 3, 4, 5, I don't know how many years of anguish, agony, and faith.
John Dominic Crossan is the author of Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. We spoke last spring, just before Easter. This is Fresh Air. During this national fundraiser, we've saved some time to rebroadcast some of our most popular interviews from the recent past, like the interview you just heard with John Dominic Crossan. We received many phone calls and letters from listeners who appreciated hearing a man with deep convictions, thinking out loud about his faith, and using the tools of history to better understand it. We here at Fresh Air are very grateful to our guests who give us so much when they reflect on their lives and their work. On a day like today, we have to interrupt the reflections with some straightforward facts. To preserve this forum for reflection, we need your support. Not just your moral support, but your financial support in the form of a pledge. I'll thank you in advance. Here's how to make that pledge. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says singer Johnny Hartman has just about the lightest touch and lightest timbre of any jazz baritone who came along in the wake of Billy Eckstein. The early 1960s was a peak period for Hartman, who died in 1983. Kevin has this review of The Voice That Is, a reissue of a 1964 Hartman album.
Candlelights on corner tables remind me of you. Perfume and silk stockings make me think of you. A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart is wings. These foolish things remind me of you.
That's Johnny Hartman on the album The Voice That Is. Hartman is best known for an album he recorded in 1963 with John Coltrane's quartet. The combination of Hartman's ballad baritone and Coltrane's pleading tenor can give you goosebumps. Hartman's other early 60s albums for Impulse aren't that good, but they're worth hearing too. On The Voice That Is, as with Coltrane, Hartman eased off on the heavy vibrato and operatic effects he went in for in the 1950s. The quiet arrangements Bob Hammer wrote fit the singer's understatement, and they fit the mood of the song. Some tunes and some charts are a little corny, but there's something to be said in favor of novelty instruments and odd timbres for their own sake. The song A Slow Hot Wind is by Henry Mancini and Norman Gimbel.
Over me like a slow hot wind. Some days it's too warm to fight a slow hot wind.
Jazz vocal fans still like those bedroom baritone voices, when they can find one. You can tell that from all the attention singer Kevin Mahogany got when he turned up last year. Not to knock Mr. Mahogany, who's pretty good, but the jazz baritone tradition is definitely in eclipse now. Not that it might not come back. In jazz, never count anything out. If the likes of Billy Eckstein and Johnny Hartman are scarce these days, well, the likes of them were scarce when they were alive, too.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Johnny Hartman's The Voice That Is, an Impulse recording reissued by GRP. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
It never entered my mind. You have what I lack myself. And now I even have to scratch my back myself. Once you warned me that if you scorned me, I'd sing a loser's prayer again. And wish that you were there again to get into my get into my hair again. It never entered my mind. You have what I lack myself, and now I even have to scratch my back myself. Once you warned me that if you scorned me, I'd sing a loser's prayer again and wish that you were there again to get into my hair again. It never entered. No, it never entered. It never entered my.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.